Okay, so Numbers chapter 17, and this is after the plague, and that was after the rebellion, and that was after they were told to turn back from going into Canaan and tried to go in anyway. And the question is, Deb entered the waiting room, admit.
Yeah, let her in. Let Deb in.
Okay.
She had fun probably shoveling out her car.
So heading into chapter 17, the question becomes, who is the one who will represent Israel before the Lord? And there will be an answer. Verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, verse 2,
speak to the people of Israel and get from them staffs, one for each father's house, from all their chiefs according to their father's houses. 12 staffs. Write each man's name on the staff, on his staff.
Okay.
Shouldn't have read without these.
And write Aaron's name on the staff of Levi. For there shall be one staff for the head of each father's house. Verse 4.
Then you shall deposit them in the tent of meeting before the testimony where I meet with you.
Okay. And the staff of the man whom I choose shall sprout. Thus I will make to cease from me the grumblings of the people of Israel, which they grumble against you. So the grumblings were, who put you in charge? You know what the answer is?
God.
God. Yep. But that hasn't satisfied them. So they've kept on grumbling and grumbling and grumbling. What makes you any better than us? Why can't we be just like you? And now you're lording it over us, even though they weren't lording it over. And Deb is connecting to audio and coming in. Okay. So God is going to arrange this that they will find out, and it will be something that he is going to do. And there's going to be no dispute about this, because they're not going to be able to not to deny this one. Verse 6.
You got your picture back,
though. Yeah. So Moses spoke to the Israelites, and their leaders gave him 12 staffs, one for the leader of each of their ancestral tribes, and Aaron's staff was among them.
Okay. And Moses deposited the staffs before the Lord in the tent of the testimony. That would be in the actual tabernacle, not in the courtyard, but in the holy place. And it's the tent of the testimony. So it has the Ten Commandments, the tablets, and the testimony is, of course, the record of what God has done. So, verse 8.
The next day, Moses entered the tent of the testimony and saw that Aaron's staff, which represented the house of Levi, had not only sprouted, but had budded, blossomed, and produced almonds.
Right.
Yeah. So what is the meaning of this? Well, before we get to the outward meaning of it, what do almonds symbolize? Does anybody know? This is ancient, and it's all over the ancient world in some form. think of the shape of an almond.
Eyes?
Yeah. Eye. Yeah. Hmm. Because the shape is similar to what you see in somebody's eye. And that is to say that God sees, God knows. He is the seeing God. Okay. Second, however, Aaron's staff had sprouted, put forth buds, blossoms, almonds. God is the source of life. He is the source of sustenance. And he is the life-giving God. And so the staff of Aaron was blessed in its connection with God to receive that life-giving force from God. And so it does what is natural to a staff of almond. It sprouts. And that is so that the people of Israel may know that life comes from God. He is the life-giving one. The I am that I am is also the life-giving I am. And remember that, because I'm saying it 3 and 4 times. He is the life-giving one. Because later in the chapter, there'll be a contrast with that. So, now verse 9. Then Moses brought out all the staffs from before the Lord to all the people of Israel, and they looked, and each man took his staff. Verse 10.
And the Lord said to Moses, put back the staff of Aaron before the testimony to be kept as a sign for the rebels, that you may make an end of their grumblings against me, lest they die.
Okay. Exactly where is he supposed to put it?
In front of the testimony.
Okay, what is the testimony?
The ark.
The ark. He's supposed to put it right in front of the ark. That's close in. That's Holy of Holies. Okay, so it is put there to be kept as a sign for the rebels. Hmm. And will this end the grumbling?
Probably not.
I guess I didn't realize the staff was actually a growing thing. Like,
it was what?
I didn't understand the staff being like wood, I guess, that would grow and produce buds and almonds.
It doesn't.
Yeah, that's the whole
point.
It was wood. It is dead wood. It is dried out wood.
Yeah.
You know, like a walking stick.
Right.
You wouldn't expect to be able to put a walking stick in the ground and have anything happen. Mm-hmm. And that's the staff.
But these did.
You want it dried out so that it is firm and solid.
It wasn't these that did. It was,
no,
just one
Aaron's.
That did.
Only just Aaron's.
Yeah. And it's just Aaron's. And by the way, where'd Aaron's staff come from? Because he got it from somebody. And we know who he got it from.
From God way back. Mm-hmm. When? No.
Another human being.
Moses's?
Moses.
Moses.
Was it the one he used to part the sea?
Yeah. And Moses, let's see, that was the staff that he had when he went up on Mount Sinai the first time. Mm-hmm. So it's got some history. And he threw it down and it became a snake, and then he picked it up and it became a staff.
I bet Moses hated to part with it.
Aside from, you never know when this staff is going to turn into a snake.
Well, yeah.
Here, you hold it.
Here, it's yours. I love you, bro.
And And that's no, not really, but okay. So what about the people of Israel? Verse 12.
And the people of Israel said to Moses, "Behold, we perish. We are undone. We are all undone."
Said what?
What?
Yeah. Huh?
Mm. Oh, wait a minute. They're the people that God said, "Hey, you, back into the wilderness. You're all going to die there." But is God a God of death, or is God a life-giving God? Is God the life giver? He is the life giver. And for the people of Israel, if they had realized at that point, this is the God of life, things could have been different for the different ones of the people of Israel if they had understood. Still, that is a very strange reaction to, and Aaron's staff budded. Hmm. Okay, and they go on. Everyone who comes near to the tabernacle of the Lord shall die. Are we all to perish?
So they're still grumbling in their own little endearing way.
Endearing?
Aggravating.
Yeah.
It's opposite day.
mm-hmm. The almond rod was especially adapted to exhibit this as an almond tree flowers and bears fruit, the earliest of all the trees, and has received its name of Shakad, awake. From this very fact. Okay. So that's verse 7, or chapter 17. And we got a couple of chapters of regulations. The first is the duties and the rewards of the priests and the Levites. Chapter 18, so the Lord said to Aaron, "You and your sons and your father's house with you shall bear iniquity connected with the sanctuary, and you and your sons with you shall bear iniquity connected with your priesthood." A better translation might be, "You and your sons, you carry the iniquity." Because that's what they did, is they carried the sin to be presented before the Lord and covered up.
So the priests came from the Levite tribe. They weren't, all the Levites weren't priests.
Right. Moses and Aaron were from Levi.
Okay.
And Aaron was appointed as priest. And the Levites were the ones that in the incident of the golden calf came to the Lord and stood with Moses and Aaron and were separated out from the rest of the people of Israel because of that.
Okay.
They were God's tribe, and then the tribe of Joseph got split into Ephraim and Manasseh, and yet there's a distinction between the Levites and the priests. Okay, so verse 2.
Bring your fellow Levites from your ancestral tribe to join you and assist you when you and your sons minister before the tent of the testimony.
Mm-hmm. And notice again, the tent of the testimony. They shall keep guard over you and over the whole tent, but shall not come near to the vessels of the sanctuary or to the altar, lest they and you die. So nobody comes near unless invited. verse 4.
They shall join you and keep guard over the tent of meeting for all the service of the tent, and no outsider shall come near you.
Mm-hmm. And you shall keep guard over the sanctuary and over the altar, that there may never again be wrath on the people of Israel. So the coming close to God while grumbling, complaining, and rebelling gets you in trouble. Verse 6.
And behold, I have taken your brothers, the Levites, from among the people of Israel. They are a gift to you, given to the Lord, to do the service of the tent of meeting.
Okay. So speaking to Aaron, who is the priest, the Levites are given to him as a gift from among the people of Israel to assist with all that has to do with the priesthood. Verse 7, and you and your sons with you shall guard your priesthood for all that concerns the altar and that is within the veil, and you shall serve. I give your priesthood as a gift, and any outsider who comes near shall be put to death. So the priesthood is a gift from God given to Aaron. This is not just something that Aaron has blundered into. It is from God and a very specific gift. Verse 8.
Then the Lord spoke to Aaron, behold, I have given you charge of the contributions made to me, all the consecrated things of the people of Israel. I have given them to you as a portion and to your sons as a perpetual due.
Ah, so this is for the sustenance then of the priests, that they're not to have normal possessions and accumulate wealth in the land. Instead, God is their wealth. God is to be their everything. And because of that, then from their service to God, they are given contributions. Verse 9, this shall be yours of the most holy things reserved from the fire, every offering of theirs, every grain offering of theirs, and every sin offering of theirs, and every guilt offering of theirs, which they render to me, shall be most holy to you and to your sons. Verse 10.
In a most holy place shall you eat it. Every male may eat it. It is holy to you.
So from the offerings there was, and we read this earlier on numerous weeks ago, there was a portion of the offering that was set aside, and that was the due to the priests. And these offerings, which are grain, sin, guilt, offerings, those offerings had a portion that went to the priest. And then they are allowed to eat it, the priests themselves. Nobody else, not their family, just the priests in a most holy place. There's other things coming along that are for the entire family, but this is for the priests. And it is to be eaten in a most holy place. Verse 11. This also is yours, the contribution of their gift, all the wave offerings of the people of Israel. I have given them to you and to your sons and daughters with you as a perpetual due. Everyone who is clean in your house may eat it. Okay. Verse 12.
I give you all the finest olive oil and all the finest new wine and grain. They give to the Lord as first fruits of their harvest.
Okay. Verse 13, the first ripe fruits of all that is in their land, which they bring to the Lord, shall be yours. Everyone who is clean in your house may eat it. Verse 14.
Every devoted thing in Israel shall be yours.
Mm-hmm. Everything that opens the womb of all the flesh, whether man or beast, which they offer to the Lord shall be yours. Nevertheless, the firstborn of man you shall redeem, and the firstborn of unclean animals you shall redeem, because you don't take the unclean animals and offer them to the Lord. You redeem them with an offering of a clean animal. And this is, all of this is for the sustenance of the priests and their families. Verse 16.
When they are a month old, oops.
Go ahead.
Okay. You must redeem them at the redemption price set at 5 shekels of silver, according to the sanctuary shekel, which weighs 20 gerahs.
Okay. But the firstborn of a cow, or the firstborn of a sheep, or the firstborn of a goat, you shall not redeem. They are holy. You shall sprinkle their blood on the altar. Why do they call every Bible study?
Because they know we're going to be home somehow.
Yeah, I got a call. That's why I was late. Mm-hmm. Dealership called. Had to take it.
Yep. You shall sprinkle their blood on the altar and shall burn their fat as a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. Okay. Verse 18.
But their flesh shall be yours as the breast that is waved and as the bright thigh are yours.
Okay. The wave offering of the breast, the heave offering of the right thigh. There is a slight distinction made in the Hebrew.
What's the significance of the right thigh?
I don't know.
Was it Jacob that wrestled with God?
Mm-hmm. That's his hip.
Which side did he... the Lord pulled on,
couldn't tell you, although I've found out at various times, but the thigh apparently is seen as the best part of the meat.
Oh.
Which would be why it would be reserved. But all of this, if the some notes from Delitzsch, receiving this, if they were to receive that with the size of the tribe of Levi, this would be more food than they could consume. If you're figuring a tithe from the people of Israel, it would be immense. But as in our day, so says Delitzsch, so in their day, people did not always give a proportionate gift to God. They gave much, much less than they were called upon by God to give. And at the same time, if you look around at the other nations in the world in that era, such as the priests of Egypt, they didn't just receive a nice sustenance what they took from the people of Egypt was make them very, very, very wealthy indeed. They became the elite through what was obligated to them. They became a ruling class. Not so in Israel.
My Bible had made mention of that in relationship to Korah, and that was possibly one of the reasons that there was a rebellion, was they wanted the power behind the mm-hmm. leadership.
Mm-hmm. And add in wealth, and there you go.
Mm.
Yeah. Because what they learned in Egypt from looking at the priests there was, ooh, this is a nice gig.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the priests in Egypt lorded it over them. And so it was almost like, even though Moses and Aaron weren't doing that,
mm-hmm.
they saw them as doing it. You know how you don't say anything and people think you're stuck up? Well, they could have just, yeah.
You see what you expect to see.
Mm-hmm.
Person's reputation precedes them, and then you meet them and you've got them locked into what others have told you about them.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be completely, totally false. There's a fellow I knew down in Southern Illinois who his reputation was one that lords it over everybody else. I got to know him and found out that that is not what he was about at all. But he had that reputation and there was nothing he could do about it. He had some money, so people figured he was a certain way, and he was not. That's the way with human beings. Korah and Dathan and others spread things about Moses and Aaron. And the people responded because it's so much fun to tear down another person's reputation. Yeah, remember that statement. It is so much fun to tear down another person's reputation. That's one of the great sports through all of human history. And so people will do that. And if they can get a crowd to join them in on it, good luck to the one who's being the target. I've been there, played that game.
Hmm.
And it is not fun. And there is nothing you can say or do to dissuade a crowd that is convinced of a certain thing. Absolutely nothing. There comes the plow.
Yay. Now we can't get out of our driveway, I'm sure.
No, when I shovel, I go up plow word from the driveway and I clear out snow there so that we don't get plowed in quite so easily. Anyway, and what do people say about God? And no matter what the Bible says, no matter what we teach, there are a whole lot of people in the world who've already made up their mind because somebody else has said that, you know, this is what church is about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Try and dissuade them. It is the oldest of human sports to destroy reputations.
Started in the Garden of Eden.
Oh, yeah.
With the serpent, with the devil.
Well, started with Adam.
She's the one who gave me that fruit.
yeah, turned on her really fast.
He tried to make it like God was withholding from them.
Mm-hmm.
He was trying to show what God wasn't really the good God. He was holding out on that.
You mean the devil?
No, it started with the devil.
Snake.
Yeah. That's okay. True. Okay.
The creator of sin.
We have carried it on very effectively all through human history. It is the most absolutely stunning thing. You could ask Socrates. No, you couldn't unless you die without knowing God. Anyway, but sheesh. Where were we?
19.
We kind of went off. All the holy contributions that the people of Israel present to the Lord, I give to you and to your sons and daughters with you as a perpetual due. Here's an idiom. It is a covenant of salt forever before the Lord for you and your offspring with you. So what? That refers to the preserving power of salt. So that was an idiom, a covenant of salt. God knows how to speak our language. Verse 20.
And the Lord said to Aaron,
go ahead.
And the Lord said to Aaron, you shall have no inheritance in their land, neither shall you have any portion among them. I am your portion and your inheritance among the people of Israel.
And that's pretty cool. If you have God, you have everything. To the Levites, I have given every tithe in Israel for an inheritance in return for their service that they do, their service in the tent of meeting. Verse 22.
So that the people of Israel do not come near the tent of meeting, lest they bear sin and die.
Hmm. But the Levites shall do the service of the tent of meeting, and they shall bear their iniquity. That's to carry the sins. The duty is to carry sins before the Lord. And what then do you do when you carry sins before the Lord? You present it before the Lord so that it can be forgiven. It shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations and among the people of Israel. They shall have no inheritance. Verse 24.
Instead, I give to the Levites as their inheritance the tithes that the Israelites present as an offering to the Lord. That is why I said concerning them, they will have no inheritance among the Israelites.
Mm-hmm. And so far, this is to Aaron. Verse 25, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Verse 26.
Moreover, you shall speak and say to the Levites, when you take from the people of Israel the tithe that I have given you from them for your inheritance, then you shall present a contribution from it to the Lord. There's a comma there, so I assume it continues. A tithe of the tithe.
Okay. So what went before was speaking to Aaron and giving a message to the Levites. And now spoken to Moses, the message through Moses to Aaron and the priests. Moses is still the mediator of the covenant. And Moshe is another form of the name Joshua, another form of the name Yeshua, which is salvation. And from way back in Exodus, the first couple of chapters, in Egyptian, it meant through water. And you might remember I brought in the little hieroglyphic book and the three pictograms that are combined into the name Moses are reeds, water, and little owl. The daughter of Pharaoh, it's like a little owl floating in the reeds. And so she names him Moshe, which means through water. not realizing that in Hebrew, the name means salvation. And you combine the two and you get salvation through water. And they might have suspected something when they got to the Red Sea. Salvation through water. They had hints. They had a lot of hints. So a tithe of the tithe. And the Levites and the priests are to realize that all of what they have been given comes from God. And to give the tithe to God is not as much giving what is your due as it is claiming that all you have received is from God. It's a claim that then is an acknowledgement of the gift. But as I've said before, when we bow our heads and pray a meal prayer, what we are doing is not simply acknowledging, we are claiming this that we receive is from the hand of God himself. It is not just random food and calories and meat and whatnot that we've been able to accumulate. It is from God. We claim the relationship as we do that. And that's what the priests and Levites are supposed to do in their giving of the tithe. Very important difference in the way of thinking about it. Oh, let's see, where are we?
27.
And your contribution shall be counted to you as though it were the grain of the threshing floor and as the fullness of the wine press. And as they bring their tithe, God is saying, what a wonderful thing you have done to give this gift to me. Story of my mother. Do I need to repeat it? Yeah, I'll repeat it anyway. She took me to the five a dime store, showed me what to buy for her, gave me the money, took me to the cash register, told me how to give the money to the cashier, how to receive the change, took me home, helped me wrap the present. And then when it was time to give the present to her, she opened it up and she was so wonderfully surprised.
That really is sweet.
That's what moms do.
Do you remember how you felt? Were you like, but you were with me, but, or were you just beaming with, were you just so happy?
I was too young to be going, but.
Oh, okay.
You were itty bitty.
You just remember being happy.
I didn't quite know what money was at that point. As little. And I just remember her being so surprised. And it occurred to me that she helped me pick it out and helped me wrap it. And she was so delighted. And yeah, that's what stewardship is. Okay. Hmm. That's what we get to do every week. And God says, oh, such a wonderful thing you're doing. Wherever did you think of that? Okay, verse 28.
So you shall also present a contribution to the Lord from all your tithes, which you receive from the people of Israel. And from it, you shall give the Lord's contribution to Aaron the priest.
Mm-hmm. Out of all the gifts to you, you shall present every contribution due to the Lord. From each, its best part is to be dedicated. Why? Because we love the one we are giving it to. Verse 30.
Therefore, you shall say to them, when you have offered from it the best of it, then the rest shall be counted to the Levites as produce of the threshing floor and as produce of the wine press.
and you may eat it in any place, you and your households, for it is your reward in return for your service in the tent of meeting. And before we finish up the chapter, have you noticed the phrasing produce of the threshing floor and as produce of the wine press? That's been repeated. So if you put those together, produce of the threshing floor, produce of the wine press, what is it they're talking about?
Bread and wine.
Communion.
Bread and wine.
Yeah, bread and wine. Bread and wine, which at the point is not communion, but the elements of, and it's a prefiguring of what God gives and what is a communion with him. So the tithe is a communion with God, who invites us to combine our resources and our wealth with his resources and his wealth. And which one of us is more rich? Okay, sounds like a good deal to me. Verse 32.
By presenting the best part of it, you will not be guilty in this matter. Then you will not defile the holy offerings of the Israelites, and you will not die.
Okay. That's verse 18. That's for the priests. Now, or chapter 18. Chapter 19 is laws for purification, and purification specifically from contact with a dead body. And why that is now introduced is very simply because it's 40 years out in the wilderness, crowded together. There's going to be a lot of contact with dead bodies. Not like if they were in the Holy Land and all spread out over umpteen miles. So they've got 37 years of very concentrated living, very close quarters. And so there's going to be a lot of uncleanness. And it needs to be addressed. And then God takes the opportunity to then put in another picture of salvation. And it becomes really actually quite fascinating when you trace through the parts of that picture. So, now the Lord spoke to Moses and to Aaron, saying, verse 2.
This is a requirement of the law that the Lord has commanded. Tell the Israelites to bring you a red heifer without defect or blemish, and that has never been under a yoke.
No. You might have heard at some point of the red heifer. This is it. Heifer is a not quite so young as a calf, not so old as a cow, a juvenile female reddish heifer. And there's point after point after point here. Why red? Red is, according to a lot of commentators, symbolic for blood. According to Delitzsch, it is the color of life in its full vigor. And he says, look at the blush of the face or the red of the lips. Okay. Without defect, now we're going to... we're going to be pointing toward Christ then, in which there is no blemish, and on which a yoke has never come. The full measure of life has not been compromised yet by the yoke of labor. Verse 3.
Give it to Eleazar, the priest. It is to be taken outside the camp and slaughtered in his presence.
Okay, so he is not to slaughter it. And that was the case with all of the sacrifices. An assistant to the priest would slaughter it so that the priest would not have contact at that point, and so would avoid the contact with corpse uncleanness. The person that slaughtered it would be unclean until sundown. Outside the camp. Oh, that's Hebrews 13. What is Hebrews 13 about? So Jesus also suffered outside the gate in order to sanctify the people with his own blood. Therefore, let us go to him outside the camp and bear the reproach he endured. For here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is to come. Outside the camp is outside of the community of the people of God. And when Jesus went outside of the camp, outside of Jerusalem, to go to Golgotha, it was him being rejected by man and by God so that he could be the one to carry all of the sins of the world. He could be the man of sin and be forsaken in our place. And, like the song, Canaanite, she comes to pray. Was it verse 5? Outside the camp, he came to win my soul for God and bring again mankind into communion, unraveling our twisted faith in Satan's lies. Christ's faithful death has healed our separation. Outside the camp is a very, very powerful image that points right to the center word of the cross, the central word there. And that's why all of this has to take place outside the camp for the one who bears the sin of the world. And that becomes central in everything that follows. The main point of sin is the death that it brings, the separation from God that it brings. And so that is what Christ endured. Verse 4.
And Eleazar the priest shall take some of its blood with his finger and sprinkle some of its blood towards the front of the tent of meeting 7 times.
Okay, and he is outside the camp, but he's sprinkling toward the front of the tent of meeting. Verse 5, and the heifer shall be burned in his sight, its skin, its flesh, and its blood with its dung shall be burned. The whole thing, flesh and blood. Verse 6, that if we didn't figure out yet, as New Testament people, if we didn't figure out yet what this is talking about, here comes verse 6 to hammer it home. 2x4 in the middle of the forehead. Verse 6.
And the priest shall take cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet yarn and throw them into the fire, burning the heifer.
Okay. You might remember from Leviticus 14, the sacrifice of the two birds, where the one bird is slain and its blood gathered, and the other bird dipped in the blood of the bird that was slain and allowed to fly free. And Jesus is symbolized by the bird that is slain, and we are symbolized by the bird that is allowed to fly free. And in that sacrifice, there was cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet yarn. And here it is, again, cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet yarn or scarlet wool. Cedar wood, Dalich says, is to symbolize the everlasting character of life, because cedar is an evergreen tree. I suspect that cedar, my guess is that the cross was cedar, a cedar post that you could set out there, and then the cross beam that you could attach to it. And Jesus would carry the cross beam and then be bound to the cross beam. And then they would haul that up and slot it into place in the upright and then nail the feet. That way you could put the post in place and leave it there. And because it's cedar, it would not rot so quickly. Very practical stuff that the Romans could do. And cedar, you get very straight growing cedar. So it points us to the cross. Hyssop is what they used to give Jesus a drink there on the cross, a sprig of hyssop. It's a marker. And wherever in the Old Testament you find hyssop, you find it as a marker connecting to the sacrifice. It is used to scatter the blood there in front of Mount Sinai, to take hyssop and to fling the blood of the sacrifice. And the scarlet yarn, scarlet for blood or sin or life, the whole thing blurs together. And then verse 7, then the priest shall wash his clothes and bathe his body in water, and afterward he may come into the camp, but the priest shall be unclean until evening. Verse 8.
The man who burns it must also wash his clothes and bathe with water, and he too will be unclean until evening.
And a man who is clean shall gather up the ashes of the heifer and deposit them outside the camp in a clean place. And they shall be kept, for the water for impurity for the congregation of the people of Israel. It is a sin offering. So there's something to be made of these ashes. Verse 10.
And the one who gathers the ashes of the heifer shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. And this shall be a perpetual statute for the people of Israel and for the stranger who sojourns among them. Mm-hmm.
Whoever touches the dead body of any person shall be unclean 7 days. Ah, here we are with the specifics for 37 years of dying. Verse 12.
He shall cleanse himself with the water on the third day and on the seventh day, and so be clean. But if he does not cleanse himself on the third day and on the seventh day, he will not become clean.
Okay. Third day is a picture, of course, of the resurrection. Seventh day is a picture, of course, of the Sabbath day. And then the next day following is the eighth day, and again, resurrection. But if somebody despises this, he's not clean. Verse 13, whoever touches a dead person, the body of anyone who has died and does not cleanse himself, defiles the tabernacle of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from Israel, because the water for impurity was not thrown on him. He shall be unclean. His uncleanness is still on him. So the sacrifice of the red heifer, with all of the connections in symbolism to the cross of Christ, is what is used to declare a person no longer unclean before the Lord and allowed back into the camp and into the congregation. So we go on very quickly, verse 14.
This is the law when someone dies in a tent. Everyone who comes into the tent and everyone who is in the tent shall be unclean 7 days.
And every open vessel that has no cover fastened on it is unclean. Dalich says, cover fastened on it so that the odor of the corpse may not get into the open vessel and defile the food. Yeah, that odor is... verse 16.
Anyone out in the open who touches someone who has been killed with a sword or someone who has died a natural death or anyone who touches a human bone or a grave will be unclean for 7 days.
Mm-hmm. For the unclean, they shall take some ashes of the burnt offering and fresh water shall be added in a vessel. We're not told the actual amount of ashes, but it's the ashes with the water. Verse 18.
Then a clean person shall take hyssop and dip it into the water and sprinkle it on the tent and on all the furnishings and on the persons who were there and on whoever touched the bone or the slain or the dead or the grave.
Okay, so using hyssop and dipping it in the water where there were the ashes of the heifer and sprinkling it.
And the study Bible says the water with the ashes produces a lye solution.
Yes, it does.
So it's like making soap.
And the clean person shall sprinkle it on the unclean on the third day and on the seventh day. Thus on the seventh day, he shall cleanse him and he shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water. And at evening, he shall be clean. And at evening, when the sun goes down, what day is it then? It's the eighth day.
It's the resurrection day.
Okay, verse 20.
But if a person who is unclean does not purify himself, he must be cut off from the community because he has defiled the sanctuary of the Lord. The water of cleansing has not been sprinkled on him and he is unclean.
Yeah. And the defiling, it is very much the same as the old saying on baptism. It is not the lack of baptism that gets you in trouble. It's the despising of baptism. The thief on the cross did not have it available. He was without fault regarding baptism. The person who refuses it and refuses it and refuses it and ends up despising it, that person may be in trouble before God. Let's see, 21. And it shall be a statute forever for them. The one who sprinkles the water for impurity shall wash his clothes, and the one who touches the water for impurity shall be unclean until evening. So you have to become unclean in order to clean the person who is unclean? Yeah.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, it does. Verse 22.
And whatever the unclean person touches shall be unclean. And anyone who touches it shall be unclean until evening.
Okay. And that finishes the regulations. And as we reach chapter 20, it's time to move along. And this will be toward the end of the 37 years. And they get ready to head on back, heading toward the Holy Land. A lapse of 37 years has been covered in just a few chapters.